Precursors, Commentary for the June 21st, 2025 Sabbath School Lesson by Stephen Terry, Director, Stillwaters Ministry, www.visitstillwaters.com. Above all, you must understand that no prophecy of Scripture came about by the prophet's own interpretation of things. For prophecy never had its origin in the human will, but prophets, though human, spoke from God as they were carried along by the Holy Spirit. 2 Peter 1, verses 20 and 21. Our lesson this week is based on some of the major prophecies of the book of Daniel and their relationship to the book of Revelation, as posited in Uriah Smith's 19th century tome, Daniel and the Revelation. Some of Smith's interpretations have fallen out of favor, such as identifying the Ottoman Empire as a major player in end-time scenarios. That empire came to an end after World War I, when the European powers divided up the countries of Southwest Asia as various protectorates, a situation that has contributed to almost constant warfare as the lines of those newly formed states were not based on stability, but on European greed and oligarchic grasping for the rich resources, especially oil, abundant in the area. An elementary introduction to the betrayal of the Arab people can be seen in 1962's Lawrence of Arabia, starring Peter O'Toole. The empire had been tottering for some time, and their participation in the war on the side of Germany allowed the European powers an open door to partition the region, allotting specific portions to the victors. Even those Arabs that had been on the side of the Europeans against their brothers that favored Germany had no say in where they ended up. Those Arabs had joined the fight hoping to benefit from the end of Ottoman domination. When they found the Ottomans replaced by rulers hand-picked by the Europeans instead of by those who had fought so hard for independence, the wound of that betrayal was deep and still resonates in the Arab world today. The reason I bring all of this up is because our lesson author makes clear that the Adventist position on the prophecies in Daniel, and therefore Revelation also, is historicist. What is historicism? It associates biblical prophecies with actual historical events and identifies symbolic beings with historical persons or societies. This is not necessarily a poor approach when it is coupled with a willingness to revisit assumptive associations as they prove less durable over time, considering ever-changing political realities. But when specific interpretations are endorsed by a prophet, and that prophet is deemed infallible in those endorsements, the position of a historicist is bound by dogma to that prophet, at risk of loss of career and livelihood. The independence and impartiality of the apologetics that derive from that and defended as historicism are no such animals. They derive instead from a need, more obvious over time, to defend that prophet, even irrationally, lest the entire house of cards collapse. Eventually that collapse will come anyway, but the apologetics are aimed at kicking the ball further down the field in hopes that such a collapse does not occur in our lifetimes. The verification of this is seen in the growing numbers of those who are no longer in denominational employ, who openly challenge those apologists. I will not address the problematic assumptions that the denomination's historicists continue to make about Daniel's prophecies here in this limited commentary. There simply is too much to cover. But those who have an interest in further study can purchase my ebook, Daniel, Stranger in a Strange Land, from Amazon. Here I will instead address issues of the interaction between religious and political power that continue to shape Christianity today, including our own Adventist denomination. Jesus faced the reality of religious institutions that had usurped power and control that were more the realm of the secular government. This was not a natural development. From the beginning, interaction with God was personal and direct. Adam and Eve walked with God in Eden. When their son Abel was favored by God, his brother Cain slew him in a jealous rage. But even then, God spoke directly to Cain, and Cain was chastened by the interaction. Noah spoke with God and followed his instructions to construct the ark for the deluge. Abraham spoke to God to plead for Sodom and Gomorrah. In time, fewer and fewer individuals sought such a relationship. Those who still interacted directly with God became known as prophets. But the idea of a prophet was different then from what we understand today. Originally, prophets were solitary individuals, itinerant, and not bound to this world's goods and sources of power. When reading the writings of the major and minor prophets of the Old Testament, we can discern an underlying harmony in their testimony. Whether Obadiah, Hosea, Ezekiel, or Isaiah, their testimony is consistent with early prophets like Samuel, Elijah, and Elisha. But our modern prophets are more inclined to the accumulation of wealth and power as they start modern denominations. And instead of perpetuating the harmony of the biblical prophets, they all claim to be inspired by God while claiming the others in competition with them for followers are not. The Mormons have Joseph Smith and Brigham Young. The Christian Scientists have Mary Baker Eddy. The Seventh-day Adventists have Ellen G. White. The Jehovah's Witnesses have Charles Taze Russell. Ironically, all of these arose in the 19th century, each claiming the mantle of the one true faith. Each claims the others are apostates, walking in darkness, bereft of the true light revealed to their founder. When Christ incarnated, he ushered in a new understanding of faith that was personal and independent of secular control, and the covetousness and greed that arise from that secularism. The first centuries that followed were a period of light and spiritual freedom, not witnessed since the days of the patriarchs. When Jesus offered that same freedom to the people, a freedom that would unfasten the chains of religious and secular oppression, the religious leaders, in league with secular powers, saw a threat to their control and the wealth they had been able to extort from the people. It is the same threat the church felt when Martin Luther challenged Johann Tetzel, who was extorting money from the poor to fill the coffers of the church in Rome. Tetzel was selling indulgences to any living relatives that promised to overcome any sins that the deceased had committed in life. In much the same way, churches extort money from people by implying their relationship with God, and therefore their salvation, is in question if they do not faithfully turn over a significant amount of their assets to the denomination. Instead of individual spiritual interaction with God, this advances the idea that the church is the intermediary between God and each believer. This idea has served many denominations well over the centuries. Ironically, the early church received funds not to enrich the church, but to redistribute to those in need, according to Acts chapter 2, verses 44 and 45, and chapter 4, verses 32 through 35. Because of the persecutions in Jerusalem, Gentiles were encouraged to send offerings to that city to relieve the need of those suffering under that oppression, not to build a kingdom on earth. But it did not take long for the church to realize this revenue stream could fund the layers of church governance that began to grow and assume control of Christianity. It also funded the explosive growth in Christian churches and monuments to early saints that took place in the 4th century, including the Archbasilica of St. John Lateran, and leading to the building of the Hagia Sophia in the 6th century. This was followed by the immense Gothic cathedrals of medieval Europe. The equivalent today is the building of universities, hospitals, seminaries, and the building supporting a vast global denominational infrastructure. Should the golden flow ever cease, all of that would collapse. This was the fear 2,000 years ago when Jesus presented his Sermon on the Mount. If money stopped flowing to the temple, the priesthood would come to an end. Despite their efforts to prevent that by killing Jesus, It ended anyway when the temple was destroyed in 70 AD, and it has never been rebuilt. Rather than seeing that for what it was, a condemnation of the inanity of promoting the idea that people could buy their way to salvation by keeping those rivers of gold flowing, to this day there are those who promote the idea of rebuilding the temple as a means to that end. The illustration accompanying this commentary is of Henry IV standing barefoot in January outside the palace of Canossa, where Pope Gregory VII was residing for the winter. The two had disputed over who had the right to appoint bishops. Since simony was widely practiced then, as it too often is today, whoever could sell the bishopric to the highest bidder stood to gain financially. When Henry refused to budge, Gregory excommunicated him. Since everyone in power has their detractors, Henry's opponents seized upon this opportunity to break from his rule, realizing the loss would be greater than the loss of funds from appointing a bishopric. Henry and his family traveled over the Alps in winter to arrive at Canossa. When he arrived, the Pope refused to see him. Henry then stood barefoot outside the castle in the harsh Alpine winter until Gregory would grant him an audience. After 3 days, the castle gates were opened, and Henry was granted an audience. Penitent, he asked for forgiveness, and the excommunication was canceled. Historically, this has been seen as a high point of the power of the Christian Church. However, Henry's reinstatement did not stop the rebellion of some of his nobles, who claimed to be loyal to Gregory, and Henry ended up marching to Rome, deposing Gregory, and setting the antipope, Clement III, on the papal throne. Just like when a wealthy man must watch out for those who would relieve him of that wealth, a church that focuses on maintaining ever-flowing streams of wealth does not go unnoticed by others that work to divert those streams to their own pockets. In Adventism, we have had many individuals who have diverted those funds through embezzlement schemes, phony investment schemes, and bold-faced efforts at the diversion of offerings and tithes to independent ministries. It should be no wonder, then, though those who already hold great wealth would not see ways that the means of the church could be diverted to fund their own pet projects. We see this in the politically orchestrated efforts to control dogma, not just in Adventism, but in every modern denomination. Those who control dogma control the levers that keep the money flowing. This is why the assumptions of the historicists cannot be questioned. They are the underpinnings of dogma. The need for reformation of Christianity is as great today, if not greater, than it was in Luther's day. If we cannot divorce ourselves from this obsession with wealth, we have learned nothing of Christ, and our lives are not in harmony with his sermons. Here at Stillwater's ministry, we do not ask for donations, and we do not accept them if offered. God has grown this ministry since 1997 to a digital presence in over 120 countries, and we have over 100,000 visitors a year, some from countries that allow no other means of gospel outreach. If the vast denominational enterprises saw their revenue streams come to an end, they would immediately collapse. God will never collapse. We recommend instead of using your means to build empires on earth, even religious empires, help the needy directly and eliminate the middleman. Despite promises, enriching the church cannot save you. Thank you for listening to this commentary podcast. You can see the written version of this podcast as well as hundreds of other commentaries and podcasts at our website at www.visitstillwaters.com. You can also find other articles and links to books by the author at that website. Once again, it's www.visitstillwaters.com. May God richly bless you and your family.